Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Heidi Moore of The Guardian, in for Brian Lehrer, and my next guest is Pete Hamill. He's a native New Yorker. He went to PS 107 in Brooklyn and explored the city not just as a native, but also as a journalist, where for decades he told the stories of the immigrants and the working classes. He was one of the voices about New York City before it became this friendly Disneyland we all know now, back when it was hard to live here. His newest book is a collection of his stories, not news stories, but fiction about Brooklyn. It's called The Christmas Kid and Other Brooklyn Stories. Pete Hamill, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Heidi.
So you said before that a journalist should be writing for the area code in which he lives. Do you still live in Brooklyn?
I don't. I can't afford it. But these stories were written while I was living in Brooklyn, and certainly Brooklyn left its mark on me. It's where I was born and was educated and grew up and went away like a lot of people do and came back, and it never leaves my system. It's part of the basic grid in what's left of my brain pan.
And in the dedication, you thank somebody named No Toes, No Sarah. You can't get more Brooklyn than that, right?
Yeah, one foot was run over by a trolley car, and he had no toes on his foot. He was a nice guy.
Yeah. So if you had to pick an area code that you were, would you be 646, 347, 516, 718?
Oh, I think 718 would be a place to spend eternity.
The old stalwart.
And I already have a plot in Greenwood Cemetery, so I know where I'll end up.
Wow. One of the most beautiful places in Brooklyn.
Yeah, right next to Boss Tweed. I figure the company will be entertaining, to say the least.
You'll never be short on booze in that plot.
If you have to spend eternity in anywhere, better with Boss Tweed than, say, Al Gore.
I hope Al Gore's not listening.
No, but you know what I mean. Make it entertaining. The rogues are often much more fun than the saints. And so are the sinners, by the way.
Well, very much to that point, you know, the cover of your book seems designed to evoke an old school Brooklyn nostalgia. It's a picture of a little kid with a sled surrounded by falling snow, windblown trees. There's a big apartment building there. And the book jacket also evokes that nostalgia. It talks about a vanished age and how the characters inhabit the old New York, the years of the Depression and the Dodgers and the Giants. But the actual stories are not actually nostalgic. I found when I was reading it, there are stories of heroin and murders and kind of a lost criminal Brooklyn, a place that's not quaint but full of deep sadness. So it really struck me that the place in your stories is not a place to be nostalgic about necessarily.
No, I don't think so. I hope the stories in some show is that there was a fundamental decency in a lot of the place, a lot of the neighborhood where I grew up, which was a basically white working class neighborhood in those days. But there was the change, the great change in my lifetime was the arrival of heroin. And heroin came in the 50s and began to change things. Doors were locked that were never locked before. People did unspeakable things, you know, robbing their own mothers, that kind of thing. But that the fundamental decency of the people is what I remember more than anything else. When I have that dedication page that you mentioned, there's like 70 people there. There's about 45 novels there. They were people of all kinds of people who helped shape me as a boy, because we were shaped on the streets. It was before television. It was before people sat and hit video games, playing games with somebody two blocks away. They went out in the street and played. Mm-hmm. I think we lost something when that happened. And if there is nostalgia, it's rooted in a sense of loss, that kind of world is basically gone. I think what's now there is infinitely better than heroin. I mean, people complain about gentrification and all that. Forget about complaining about it. It's better than the years when the druggies were everywhere. And I think the fact that it has survived and, in fact, flourished is a triumphant human story, not something to kvetch about.
A true Brooklyn word. So, listeners, I'm here with Pete Hamill talking about his compilation of stories about Brooklyn. Call us and share your Brooklyn stories, old or new. 212-433-WNYC or 212-433-9692. You can also leave us comments at WNYC.org. Click on the Brian Lehrer Show. So, Pete, to pick up on what you just said, one of the really interesting things about the Brooklyn in your stories is that it does seem like a Brooklyn that's forgotten, not just because the world is advanced and everyone has their nose in their iPhones now, but also because you write about a Brooklyn where people talk to each other, where they formed communities. You say each neighborhood was a kind of a shtetl, an urban hamlet, complete with its own lore and legends and heartbreak. Do you see that sense of community anywhere now?
Well, I can't speak for it now. I hope that it's there. I hope there are still people who, and I think it is, but I think people who recognize the humanity of other people, that they're not just numbers passing them heading for the subway, that they're individuals. People where I grew up would say things like, you see this guy walking down the block right now across the street? He's some character. They use that word, a character. How could you not want to tell his story? Mm-hmm. The presumption was there was an overriding narrative going on in the streets, and some people stood out and some didn't. And I think that must be going on around Brooklyn and other neighborhoods like that, not simply in New York, but all over the country. If we recognize the humanity of other people, we're going to want to, some of us, the people that want to tell stories and remember people, will sit down somewhere with a pen or a computer and try to tell those stories. I hope that's still going on, and I think it is. It's no accident that so many writers are now residing in Brooklyn, I think. And there's reasons for it. The human scale of the architecture, just to begin with. You're not overwhelmed by the size of buildings. You can see the sky on a beautiful day. Mm-hmm. And I think that helps attract writers who I hope will tell the stories of the people that passed them in the street.
Right. But it also feels, I'm a native New Yorker, too, and it feels like these stories have really changed. I mean, we're in a real Brooklyn moment right now, it seems. Every day there's an article about some cool new thing happening in Brooklyn, an artisanal food movement, a new restaurant. That is, safe to say, not the place you grew up with and not the place I grew up with. So what does it look like to you now when you walk those old streets of the South Slope where you used to live?
To me, it's exhilarating because where I lived in the so-called South Slope, everything has basically survived. The buildings did not burn down the way they did in Brownsville and East New York, where they are erased from memory physically. So I can walk on a corner and look up and say, there's where Mrs. Caputo lived, and May Irwin lived here, and Ann Sharkey lived here, and Carrie Woods lived there. I can do that. I remember that grid that underlies it, a kind of palimpsest that's underneath what's there now. And part of the reason I published these stories was hoping that the young who were there understand that there were people there before them, that there was another level, and that living there is a richness, not a temporary abode on your way somewhere else, but to pay attention and to understand that there were people there before. Lives of immense density were lived by people, even though they didn't put statues of them in the park after they died. Mm-hmm. You know, there were places where there was something to learn. And when the world changed, and it was not simply heroin, it was also the commerce of the port began to die. You know, a lot of these people worked on the waterfront and worked off the trade of the waterfront. But once that began to shift and change, there was still a human element that was going on. And if we're going to live in this planet, we have to recognize the humanity of each other, or else it's a very lonely way to spend an existence.
Yeah. Well, we actually have a question from Barbara in Manhattan about this. Barbara, are you there?
Hi. Yeah. No, I've enjoyed Pete Hamill for years, and he's a New York City institution. I'm just very surprised to hear him say, though, that not to fetch and not to lament gentrification, which has so destroyed so much of the color and the socioeconomic diversity of this city and every borough by pushing out people of modest means and entire ethnic groups. So I'm very surprised to hear that.
Right. And Pete, we just have a minute left. So what would you say to that?
I would say to it what I was saying saying about gentrification, that it's better than heroin. It's better than slums where people kill each other routinely. Is there a downside? Absolutely, and you put your finger in it. There has to be some place where a guy who can paint can live until he really gets someone to pay attention, or a writer, or a poet, or an ordinary citizen who wants to be able to live with Tolstoy on the shelf and Isaac Bashevis singer, too.
Yeah. And also, what's interesting about these is that these stories are fiction, but they ran in a newspaper. So
yes.
It was a very different world back then in that sense as well, right?
Yes, very much so. And in a long tradition in New York from Stephen Crane and O. Henry and Isaac Singer and many others.
Yeah.
They were there as a way to do it at a certain point.
Yeah.
And the Daily News tried to do it for a while with me.
Excellent. Pete Hamill, thank you so much for joining us. His book is called The Christmas Kid and Other Brooklyn Stories. I'm Heidi Moore, in for Brian Lehrer. We'll be back after the break with something the old Brooklyn could have really understood, a discussion of gambling and stimulants. Stay with us.